Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. Your host, Eric Davis, here with you for another exploration of the cultures of consciousness. I think probably like a number of people listening to this show, I often enjoy finding myself in situations that I don't understand. And I particularly love slipping into what I call the alien anthropologist, which is a wonderful thing to have in your back pocket, because even in situations where, you know, maybe it's not even that fun, some weird scene you're stuck with or a terrible party that somebody dragged you to, or you know, you're in like a border crossing in some weird country, and it's really depressing and the light's bad, but you can't go anywhere because they have your papers and you have to be there for 5 hours, and you're in these situations and you go like, well, let's pretend that I'm actually an alien on this planet. And then suddenly it's the most fascinating place in the world. Everything, people's gestures, how it looks, how the room is structured. And it's this way of being kind of inside and outside experience at the same time. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, we get too detached and we need to have more like direct experience and live our lives and not be so kind of distant or always mediated, et cetera. And, you know, there's a degree of truth to that. But it's also the case that, you know, being a conscious human being is often being to some degree or another alienated. But rather than being, you know, detached and negative about the situation you're in, there's this kind of cultivation of curiosity, a sort of critical wonder that I associate with this act of anthropology, which can, when we think of anthropology, you think of like going to some, you know, a non-developed or underdeveloped, jungle tribe or something. But of course, you know, opportunities for anthropology are everywhere, even in the home, which is where the alien anthropologist can be an anthropologist anywhere. But it's that combination of appreciation, of insight, and questioning that goes on in those environments that in my experience has led to some really remarkable encounters, as well as just kind of enjoying the amazing diversity of human expression in human situations. And luckily today, you know, I'm just a hack, but we have a real anthropologist on the show, Michael Brown, who we'll be talking to in a minute. First, I'd like to invite on our lovely co-host, Maja Daou from Los Angeles. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, Eric?
Pretty good. So what do you think of all the weird scenes or interesting situations or countries that you've been in? Where was the place where you most felt like you were like an alien anthropologist checking out some, you know, new discovery?
Oh, man, that's totally easy. It was at a show in L.A., and it's funny, like you said, it was a show that I got dragged to, and I was like, you know, we were kind of the older people there. Everyone was like teenagers, you know, and I mean, not that you would know how it feels to be the oldest person in a show, but I literally felt like a total alien, and everyone was so into the band that was playing, because they were like some big pop band, you know, and I just felt like I didn't relate at all, like I wasn't even part of what was happening, so I, like you, kind of stepped outside myself and surveyed the scene just on an anthropological level, and like that happened to me. It was at Warped Tour, which, you know, I mean, Warped Tour has just become this entirely different thing. And just watching the way that people were behaving, I felt like I was watching monkeys. Like, I seriously felt like it was monkeys that I was watching and that they weren't people. It was a very profound experience.
That's very peculiar. Well, with that in mind, we'll turn to somebody who has, I don't think he studied monkeys, but he studied people in a variety of different contexts. Michael Brown is the Lambert Professor of Anthropology and Latin American Studies at Williams College, and I had the opportunity to meet him last year, and we hit it off greatly, and I was not familiar with his work, and it turned out that he'd done really interesting earlier work on shamanism in the Amazon, and he wrote a wonderful book about channelers called the Channeling Zone that we'll talk about later in the show. So, Michael, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Nice to be here, Eric.
Great, great. So I want to start out with this cool article you sent. You know, I think I told you that we often talk about ayahuasca on this show just because it's such a fascinating phenomena, both in the in the native context and the mestizo context, and also just as it's spreading through the West. And it's such an intense, otherworldly kind of experience and world, and yet it's really becoming part in many ways of our contemporary mindscape in not unproblematic ways, and yet it's something that we really keep coming back to because it brings a lot of issues on board. And so it was wonderful to read your piece, The Dark Side of the Shaman, which I guess came out in the late 80s in Natural History. So I would just love to hear, this is presumably your first work, or you know, your first major field work or whatever, but I'd love to hear about like why you decided to go to the jungle, how that came about, what you wanted to find, what you thought you'd find.
Well, it was kind of a classic story of anthropology. I'd done some work in Peru as a graduate student, and when it came time, I actually worked at very high altitudes, and while I loved the scenery, I decided I actually liked breathing. It was important to my well-being, and living at 15,000 feet above sea level was kind of tough. So I happened to visit friends who are working in the western Amazon or eastern Peru, just east of the Andes, and I just fell in love with the region. So when it came time to do my doctoral work, to make a long and complicated story short, I ended up taking residence in a community of Aguarun or Awahun indigenous people, as they call themselves now. And I lived in one village for about a year, and then I moved to another village just to get a kind of comparative perspective. So I was in Peru altogether about 2.5 years for that work, which I needed to complete to do my dissertation. And then after I finished my PhD, I went back a number of times through the 1980s until the insurgency of the Shining Path and the cocaine trade made it just too dangerous to work, or I felt that it was unsafe, partly because I did one interview at gunpoint, and I thought maybe it was time to do something else for a while. So I worked consistently with the Aguaruna through the middle to late 80s, and then turned my attention to other things. So I haven't spent a lot of time with them since. But in it was classical kind of Margaret Mead field work, in the sense that I lived in this little village. I lived right in the middle of the village. I didn't speak the language when I got there. There were hardly any people in the village who spoke Spanish. So I had to be like a toddler and learn to speak basic Awahun until I got a working knowledge of the language. And basically I did what people did. And if they worked in the fields and I could accompany them, I went along. And if there were things going on in the village, I sat around and tried to follow it as much as I could, and then as I got better, I had more facility in the language, my research got more directed. But in the context of that period, the second village I lived in particular had probably the most heavily trafficked or busiest shaman in the region, and so when he did healing sessions, I typically attended if I could. What makes the Aguaruna case a little different from other parts of the Peruvian Amazon is that the shaman is the only one who takes the ayahuasca at these sessions. There were other situations where larger groups of people would take ayahuasca, but those situations don't arise much anymore. And in fact, the Aguaruna say that if you're not a shaman, you won't actually have a vision or you won't have any effect when you take the particular version of ayahuasca that the shaman uses. And so it was sort of this peculiar situation in which I was really interested in ayahuasca, but it wasn't culturally appropriate for me to take it. So I went as an observer and to some a limited extent as a participant, watching the shaman heal people, and I attended a number of these events.
So I'm curious, when you were, you know, first sort of had this encounter, What kind of, I mean, to be reflexive, like what sort of ideas or expectations or hopes did you have when you were like, hey, there's this shaman, there's going to be a way, even if you weren't going to, you know, be partaking, just in terms of how they, did you have your own kind of myth of the shaman going into the situation, even though, of course, you were working against it as a good, you know, field, you know, observer.
Well, I was raised in the generation that we were weaned on Carlos Castaneda, right? So I suppose the fantasy, I mean, I had particular things that I wanted to study, but it would have been wonderful if the shaman had been willing to take me under his wing and make me an apprentice and that sort of thing. And I pitched it to him, and basically he said no. And the more, I was disappointed, but he had no objection since I was a member of the community and the events were more or less public. If I came, there was certainly no problem with that. And in the end, I ended up thinking that it was probably better the way things turned out, because in this society, shamanism is so tied up in violence and sorcery accusations. It's not this kind of, it's not like people in, you know, saffron robes, you know, experiencing their oneness with the universe. It's engaging in a violent struggle, a spiritual struggle that can have real world implications, against evil, against the evil intentions of people who've blown, you know, spirit darts into their enemies and want to see them suffer and die. And so it's very, if I'd become too deeply involved in it, I would have, of course, been the subject of, or the target of, a lot of suspicion and fear, and potentially I could have been killed, as this shaman was some years after I ended my fieldwork period. So in a way, I was glad that I had a little bit of distance on the phenomenon as it was practiced in this particular society. And it's not as unusual as people think. So,
well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, of course, it's, you know, extremely hard to generalize well about anything, but certainly about you know, an area like the Amazon with these, you know, myriad groups, very different histories, different situations. But my impression is that at least finally now, speaking from the kind of popular level rather than the, or, you know, the sort of informed popular level rather than the academic study, I think it's now pretty clear that anybody who really looks at this stuff, that there's actually a fair amount of, you know, violence and dark side and sorcery and dart throwing and all that. But there was quite a long time where, at least in the, again, sort of informed to some degree popular realm, where people just didn't even talk about that side of shamanism. But my question is about, you know, if you can generalize, was that a particular situation with the Aguaruna, or was it, or was,
well,
would you,
I think,
say that there's
probably,
sort of like it appears all over the place?
The violent end of the spectrum, but it's very common. In fact, there are some areas of Colombia, not too far in eastern Ecuador, where shamanism is at least as tied into accusations and ultimately homicides as it is among the Aguajun. So I think it's not as unusual as it may sound. Where it gets complicated is, as you mentioned earlier, ayahuasca consumption has also been pulled into the mestizo world, and there's a whole tradition, a synthetic tradition of mestizo healing, and that obviously involves sorcery, but it's also part of a broader sense of that. I mean, there's a lot of focus on purging, and it's the purging effect of ayahuasca that's considered to be one of the reasons why it's a healthy practice, that it purges literally parasites and illnesses and, you know, dirt in a kind of metaphysical sense from people's body. So it's almost a, what you call it, a kind of hygienic practice, but also has this powerful visionary element to it. And that was not really the case. That expression of ayahuasca consumption was not really found among the Aguajun.
Well, in that context, let me ask you, what do you think about these, like, ayahuasca tourist groups that, like, or even shamans that participate in these groups, giving, dosing all these people with ayahuasca that, you know, that aren't shamans and aren't prepared to deal with that kind of sorcery aspect of it and the battling demons? I mean, because we've talked to other folks on the show that lead groups down there to, you know, give them this ayahuasca without, like, kind of, you know, telling them about some of this stuff and just kind of lead it through when it happens, when they confront a demon. But what do you think about that practice that is going on?
Well, I guess I would say, I mean, I haven't had any firsthand experience of it. I've read a lot of the same books and I've met some of the people. And there is a sort of politics of this that various people have tried to draw me into, but I just didn't feel that I knew enough about it to really get to take a position. I'd say in balance, it's probably harmless in the sense that outsiders who come to participate in these events are not part of the system of, you know, justice and accusation and recrimination and vengeance because they're outsiders. So in that sense, they're insulated from a lot of the kind of micropolitics of living in small communities, which also has a spiritual as well as a sort of obviously political basis or expression. I could imagine ways in which it could go awry. I mean, these are powerful drugs, psychotropics, and sometimes, and the experience, by all accounts, is overwhelming, and you're in an alien environment, and in some ways a hostile environment. So I could imagine things running off the rails for people, just as they could in any similar situation elsewhere. You know, taking peyote or mushrooms or LSD. Especially if they have unresolved issues or psychological problems. So,
well, there's also this interesting question about like the about appropriation, where on the one hand, you know, like you can say, oh, people are going down there, and then that means that like maybe the shamans are starting to like sell their services to tourists, and that changes the whole thing. And you know, some people would respond and be like, no, that's wrong. We need to like not interfere and do our our typical Western imperialism. But on the other hand, there's a way in which that attitude kind of undermines the agency of the people, which is that maybe they don't have a choice about having to encounter Westerners at all. But once that encounter starts to happen, then, you know, they're actors in negotiating how their reality is going to change as much as we are. And one of the ways that that might change in a beneficial way is to develop this kind of world where some version of these traditional practices gets sort of carried forth but transformed as it encounters these other people, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a weird way in which, like, there's kind of an unspoken kind of superiority in the sense that the native agents can't, like, come up with their own way to deal with the fact that people are interested in their practices.
Yeah,
but what do you think about that?
I think that's fair. I mean, again, if you're talking about mestizo shamanism, which takes place in places like, you know, Pucallpa or Iquitos, which are these very large, in some ways, cosmopolitan cities, I think the appropriation element of it or the dimension of it is probably not all that significant for the reasons that you mentioned, that people know how to manage it. I mean, obviously, they're sort of making it up as they go along, but they're used to dealing with outsiders, and it provides legitimate opportunities for them. I think if it involves, if people are going to really remote, tiny communities, just the presence of the outsiders in a kind of unregulated way could be destructive and could distort things in the community. And even if the shaman thinks that it's a good idea, there may be other people in the community who are affected in some way. So I think it's like everything. I mean, I think that scale is an issue, and if it's fairly small groups going into fairly cosmopolitan settings, I think it's probably fine. But you know, having large groups of people parachuting into incredibly remote communities strikes me as a really terrible idea. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but only slightly.
Right. Well, another question about the main shaman you talked about is, I don't know how to say his name, Yankush,
well, which wasn't his real name because he was still alive at the time I was writing in, so I had to use a pseudonym to protect him.
So how was your impression of the way in which he, well, I don't know what the best word is, integrated, engaged, et cetera, this kind of dark or violent potential of the practice? Meaning, like, is it something that's just like, look, this is just, it's like the way that even the best, most idealistic cop that you can imagine has to fight the bad guys and get violent sometimes. That's like one model of how, like, a good person integrates the necessity of violence or a world where there's sorcerers and you have to deal with them. But it seems to me that things get much more ambiguous than that, where even the line between a healer and a sorcerer becomes kind of blurred. And after working with him and seeing him and the stories you tell, and clearly there's, you know, there's some very heavy politics and heavy social violence in the background, what was your impression of how the healing and the sorcery went together?
Well, the healing and sorcery were, I mean, healing and shamanism in general in this society is a deeply ambivalent power. I mean, it's sort of like an analogy would be something like a radiologist who's messing around with really powerful nuclear material to, you know, heal your cancer or to take an X-ray. But, you know, if he misuses it, it could actually kill you, right? Or if he lacks the competence to use it in a safe and appropriate way, it could be deeply harmful, right? So, and in a way, shamanism in among the Awahoon is exactly the same. It's understood that the shaman, especially if he's your kinsman, is going to try and work on your behalf to heal you or heal members of your family. But at the same time, other people who don't have that close relationship think of him as somebody who is in possession of potentially destructive powers, and he's the first person they would accuse if something bad happens to them or some member of their family. So that the moral standing of a shaman in Awahoon society is entirely contextual. You know, your healing guy is somebody else's killer. Now, there are also covert shamans, or as people believe that there are hidden shamans or sorcerers who are not publicly accessible, and they're the worst kind. But even the ones who are publicly known and who work and whose healing powers is well known, you know, have to confront the fact that there are also suspicious characters in the minds of many of their countrymen. And in fact, in this case, Jan Kusch had identified some, actually just about the time I arrived in the area, he had identified or he alleged that someone had been a sorcerer who had killed a senior man in the community who had keeled over, I would say, from, you know, a heart attack or a stroke or something, and died. And he and several other men tracked the young man down, and they murdered him. This was not a spiritual killing. It was, you know, up close and personal.
Well, what do you think about, how would you apply that to, like, Western doctors? And I always think this is interesting because the word pharmacy, like the Greek word pharmacy, actually means sorcery. So it's literally like doctors today are similar in how, like, people will murder abortion doctors. Like, kind of, that's a little similar in how there's just, like, lawsuits against doctors and all the iatrogenic things. Like, do you think that kind of relates to the shaman, like how we see our doctor in our Western society?
Well, I would say it relates to it in the following way. In those very rare cases where they discover that a doctor has misused his power, I mean, there are those odd cases where, you know, physicians actually killed patients for whatever reason or has abused them when they're in his care. I mean, I think there's a real horror. There's even more horror in the face of that than just an ordinary person doing the same thing, precisely because there's so much trust and responsibility invested in the physician, and when he or she abuses it, the community rises up. The shamanic case among the people I worked with is a little bit more complicated in that right from the get-go, I think it's seen that shamanism is almost inherently ambivalent or ambiguous in a moral sense. So I think I mentioned in the natural history article, I'd go to communities and I was just curious, and I'd go to a new village and I'd say, oh, by the way, do you have a shaman in the village? And then instead of saying yes or no, they'd say, why would we have a shaman? We get along here. We don't have any problems in this community. Which was very expressive of the kind of moral ambiguity of the shaman. And you know, it's not unusual if you think about it. Shamans are people who move between two worlds, and they confront evil, and they have to experience all kinds of deprivations, and they have to essentially acquire killing power to dominate it, control it, and reverse it. And other people understand that once you've got this kind of killing power, that the temptation to misuse it might well be, you know, overwhelming.
Yeah, one of the things I kind of muse about is as the kind of Western countercultural or New Age encounter with Amazonian shamanism and mestizo shamanism there too, since that tends to be more of the source and the people that they're meeting, nonetheless, that you know, initially, of course, a lot of people have fairly romantic and fairly idealistic ideas about cultures that are purely devoted to healing, and they kind of keep the shadow side to the edge. And then people find out more and more, and it becomes clear there's more and more encounter, and whether, like, there'll be at some point when these people who have been who are pursuing some kind of, you know, New Age healing, expansion of self through these practices, kind of recognize that they really are package deals in a way, that there is this sort of, and it's that meaning that that moral ambiguity isn't just in that particular social form, that there's something about exploring the shamanic realm itself that opens up these, you know, ambiguous possibilities. And it's very interesting to see how contemporary Westerners who are engaged with this path on whatever level they think they're doing it, both kind of circumscribe and even to some degree become fascinated with this sort of the sorcery dimension of it. It's like they get more than they bargain for sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's what led me to write the article for Natural History. It literally is a case where I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on a sabbatical writing a book about something else, and I kept running into people who are involved in this kind of work, you know, the metaphysical work of one sort or another, and some of them even identify themselves as shamans. And I'd say, oh, really? I mean, do you have a sorcery problem here in Santa Fe? And they say, oh, no, it has nothing to do with that. And so I just wrote this little piece, literally sort of drafted it up in a night, just saying, okay, you think you know what shamanism is? Well, here's what, you know, here's what a lot of shamans do and how they think about the world. And it wasn't to make fun of, you know, people involved in this kind of work in our society. It was simply to say, you know, be careful where you're headed because there's this other dimension to it, and you really have to come to terms with that in a way. And that actually was partly a stepping stone towards my own field work with people involved in spirit channeling of one sort or another.
Yeah, and that's sort of the next obvious place to talk. I mean, I want to say again, I was not familiar with your book, The Channeling Zone. It's not as well known as it should be because it came out in the late 97, the late 90s,
that's right.
And it's a wonderful book. I mean, it's really fun to read, and like it's so. You're so careful to let people speak for themselves, and you get the sense again of that to me is one of those wonderful things, the ethical things about anthropology, where there's a kind of acceptance of other people's commitments and other people's practices. At the same time, there's a commitment to your own, you know, critical distance and your own sort of trying to understand how these things work. So I you know, I thought I knew a lot about channeling, but I really found out a lot from reading this book. But again, we got to take a break here for a second, but then we have time for one question. What kind of led you in that direction? I mean, out of all the different things you could be studying, you know, it's getting a little hairy in Peru. What am I going to look at? What led to?
Well, that's right. I felt in '89 that I had to suspend the work in Peru. I was writing a book about this other messianic guerrilla movement in Peru in the 1960s. So I was working on that, and as one does when you're writing a book, you find all kinds of ways of not writing the book. And so I started meeting New Age people in Santa Fe, and then I started reading about the movement, which I didn't know much about, and I just couldn't find any work that, in other words, were books written by people involved in the movement, and there are all kinds of books that made fun of or, you know, pilloried the movement for a kind of moral relativism and so on. But I didn't find any that walked that right line between letting, you know, being analytical but not trashing people's belief system. And frankly, I couldn't see any reason why, or at least in many cases, New Age beliefs and practices were any more threatening or morally compromised than many other religious movements. So I felt that there was a space for a book that, as you said, tried to sharply, you know, give the reader a sense of what was going on in the movement, but didn't come with a, you know, an agenda, a critical agenda.
Well, I think at this point we'll take a break here on the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Majadou. We're talking with anthropologist Michael Brown, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, the Progressive Radio Network.
The Burt Cohen Show brings you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all and gives you the information you need to build freedom, community, and a much better world. This is Burt Cohen. My past shows include The New Media Power of Comcast, Socialism for Wall Street Only, and How to Empower Your Own Community Over Corporate Interests. For archives, go to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and listen to The Burt Cohen Show every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. The Burt Cohen Show. There's really nothing like it.
Are you asking questions about the fate of our planet, your spiritual direction, and how to find meaning in a fast-paced society? Voices of Wisdom with John Jeanette is here to answer those questions and more. Tune in every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear sacred activists and teachers exploring the meaning of contemporary culture. The show is produced by Wisdom University with regular commentary by Jim Garrison and Will Tagle. I'm your host, John Jeanette, and I look forward to your questions.
Calling all women, are you looking for truthful answers to help you safely and naturally navigate the many hormonal challenges that you face during your lifetime? This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. I'm a naturopathic doctor, author, psychotherapist, writer, and women's health advocate. Join me entering into the Women's Healing Circle, a weekly call-in show with the holistic practitioners, authors, researchers, and wise elders who share truthful information, education, and wisdom. Join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time to enter the Women's Healing Circle right here on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Michael Brown about shamans and spirits and all that fun stuff. Michael, people don't usually put channeling into a very kind of positive, discerning research mode. Like, usually when you think of channeling, you'll think of, you know, Benjamin Cream as Maitreya or like Ramsa, and it kind of gets this bad rap, and people put it strictly into New Age parameters, and people forget about the role of channeling in terms of, like, say, a shaman healing a disease, or like, say, Nikola Tesla channeling something to figure out the alternating current, or like kind of that other role that channeling can play. I mean, after you did all your research on it, what kind of role in our society as human beings do you think that channeling spirits really play?
Well, let me just back up a bit and say I picked channeling. The problem is the New Age movement is just so gigantic and so amorphous and constantly changing that I had to decide, I had to narrow the focus a little bit because I'm an ethnographer. I work face-to-face with people, and, you know, you have to make decisions about what you can actually cover. And I really felt that because of my concerns and my dislike, or what would I say, my moral qualms about cultural appropriation, I decided to steer away from people who were doing, like, Native American, you know, medicine wheel work and things like that. I just didn't feel that I could be fair-minded about it because I just find it very troubling. But channeling has a huge advantage in that it's a very old tradition. I mean, it's called spiritualism or spiritism. It goes back over a century in the United States, back to certainly the mid-19th century, and there were even European antecedents. And so it was a Western practice. It really came from, you know, my own culture, and so I didn't feel that it was freighted with the same sets of issues that, you know, that would have affected my feelings about what I was studying. And so, and Santa Fe is a great place to work because there's just so many people. And it's true that I tended to stay away from the kind of celebrity channels, though I interviewed a couple and I participated in a workshop with Kevin Ryerson at the Omega Institute here in Eastern New York. And that was fun. Ryerson's a character, and he's a lively guy. But I was really interested in kind of the grassroots level of channeling. In some cases, you know, really small groups, people just kind of experimenting with it. And so, and in fact, many of the people I interviewed said, you know, I just don't, what I'm running away from is gurus and people on power trips, and I decided I wanted to take charge of my own spiritual insight, and I learned how to do this, and I actually participated in a workshop that taught me how to be a channel. I guess I'm now a certified channeler, so I haven't been working too much in that area recently, but it was fun. I mean, part of what I liked about it, well, first of all, I found the people I was interviewing to be a whole lot more imaginative than many of my academic colleagues, and you and Eric will appreciate that. They actually were just had a kind of free-form curiosity about the world that I found incredibly seductive and engaging. Often their minds were not disciplined in the way that academics want them to be disciplined, but that didn't matter. I just really had fun, and so I just had to throw myself into it and do the best I could. And obviously, the book deals with some tough issues, like the kind of moral relativism, you know, that people criticize channelers for, saying, you know, yeah, I was abused because I'm working through some karmic issue from a previous life or something, rather than because I was made a victim by some evil person. And there were troubling aspects of it that I documented, but there were many aspects that were kind of uplifting and fun and seemed.
What about like demonic possession? Did you ever get into like the demonic channel? Like,
no,
what if someone channels a bad spirit?
It really wasn't a significant part. I probably would have looked at something like that if it had crossed my path, but I found almost no incidents of it. I mean, there were cases where people channeled or became channels for spirits whose presence, whose arrival they hadn't really expected or anticipated, and who were scared or sort of unstrung by what happened to them. But in many cases, they learn to just sort of control it or get used to it and shape the experience in ways that they ultimately found positive and productive of personal growth. But I wanted to cover as much of the full spectrum of channeling, and it's a broad spectrum. So I went to, you know, churches where there were one or more channelers who really had sort of worship services that were partially channeled. I went to workshops, as I mentioned, where people were taught channeling, you know, to sort of tap into their own spiritual connection to the universe, whatever form that it took. There were some that were focused more on gender issues, some prosperity issues, as much diversity of focus as I could find. And in general, I found people where, in those cases where I had to identify myself as an anthropologist, they were very happy to talk about what they did, and they were fabulous informants. And the problem wasn't getting people to talk, which is often the problem for anthropologists, it was getting them to stop at some point.
How did your sense of, like, you know, even though ultimately, and even channelers themselves ultimately bracket often, like, what is quote unquote actually going on? Are these actual entities? Are they higher parts of the self, etc.? But I'm just curious, not so much about that question specifically, but just in general, how your impression of the sort of, you know, ontological validity of this stuff changed as you saw it happen. Did it become more performative and more like, oh, I see how these things work, or did you actually have a sense that there was something at least genuinely enigmatic going on, at least with some of the
well, personally, I didn't find a kind of parapsychological development to it or dimension to it, and in fact, a lot of the people I spent time with and interviewed didn't really even make much of that. They saw it as a useful instrument for them, and their view was, if it works for you, great. If it doesn't, that's fine, too. I had to admit I was disarmed by the kind of openness of the model. It wasn't, you have to believe this. It was, this is going to happen, and keep an open mind and see if you can find something useful in it for yourself. And, you know, the spirit that in the end, at the end of the book, I talk about how I came to understand or see what I saw as a play dimension, a dimension of a kind of a ludic quality to it. It was like, let's just explore this and see where it goes. And it may not be something that I spend more than a few months or a year or two working on, and then I'll move on to something else. But it's a really useful process. So to take an obvious example, many women who I interviewed ended up serving as channels for male entities. And so when they channeled, some were more dramatic than others, some of it was more performative than others, but they all, in their words, they would experience, you know, this male energy. They would sort of get used to the idea of explore this part of themselves, which was underdeveloped, but using the channeled entity as a vehicle, they would come to understand, get in touch with, and in some way incorporate this male experience. And they found it tremendously uplifting and important to them, even if they then moved on to something else afterwards. And some of the men, there wasn't quite perfect complementarity there, but many of the men, I didn't meet many men who channeled female entities, but they often channeled what they described as genderless entities. So they kind of were able to step out of their masculinity into something that was less gender marked, and they sort of get in touch with their feminine side, as they said, and they found that really useful and broadened their scope, and they felt that it helped them with their partners and so on. So this, I came to admire, or at least acknowledge, the kind of playful dimension of it, which is very different from, you know, the kind of received truth model of religion and spirituality.
Well, that strikes me as it's something else you talk about in the book, is just the idea of pragmatism, the idea that there's not as much investment in, like, the whole architecture of the belief so much as just a willingness to experiment with the possibility that this might be worthwhile, or that the value of these proclamations, even from the channels themselves, was not that they revealed the ultimate truth about the universe, but that they were useful to people, and that was really the measure that counted. And that's really interesting from a number of perspectives. One, because it is so different than most religion historically, mm-hmm. which especially in Christian country has such a premium on belief, where like belief is like the whole thing. Like if you change your beliefs according to some interpretations of Christianity, you got it. That's all you need to do is change your beliefs. And here we're in a situation that's much more diffuse, but it's also about how that resistance and negativity that people all over the rest of the culture feel towards New Age people. And a lot of it is, if you ask them, it's like, oh, they believe all this stupid stuff. They believe in UFOs. They believe in, you know, that we are UFO, whatever. And it's like, yeah, they kind of do, but that's not really where it's at. And in a way, the model of the game or this playfulness seems a lot closer. But do you think is it effective, or is it only really just a certain kind of person who's going to find that religiously satisfying? Or?
Well, I think it's true that most of the people I was meeting, and probably the preponderance of people drawn to the New Age movement, are just people who have had bad experience with faith-based congregations that demand certain kinds of stable beliefs. You know, they just find it too restrictive, too authoritarian, too limiting. And they're just exploring other possibilities, and you could put a negative spin on it by saying it's a kind of narcissistic search for a personal religion that suits your needs and has nothing to do with a community, and that's not completely wrong. I mean, the individualism, the idiosyncratic quality of the movement is very hard to reconcile with the long-term commitment associated with living in a group that, you know, shared sense of purchase and purpose and the sacrifice that inevitably entails, which is why there aren't that many stable New Age groups. I mean, there are a few, but they, you know, they have usually live in a place and are focused on some concrete tasks that they pursue as part of their spiritual work.
Well, and I'm curious if in groups that you worked with, was there like imbalance? Like, what if someone could successfully channel an entity and then everyone else kind of like, they didn't really have anything going on? Like, is that, because that kind of seems like how guruism really happens, right? Like, someone kind of has an experience, and then the rest of the dudes that they're hanging out with don't have that experience, but then they're intrigued because they see it happening. I mean, I know you were hanging out with, like, the kind of how-to channel groups where everyone would try and do it, but did you find, like, jealousy and issues like that come up with, like, what if someone's better at channeling than someone else?
Well, clearly some people had more facility for it than others. I think some people actually enjoyed being a spectator. They just felt that it was too risky to sort of go deeper into this. I mean, there was a kind of, you know, audience cult dimension to this, but most of the people, again, I didn't spend a lot of time with one of these sort of very authoritarian channelers of whom I'm sure your listeners can think of some names, and there were a bunch of reasons why I didn't go down that road. I think that's a part of the movement that needs to be looked at, but just, you know, numerically, it was a tiny fragment of the movement. I did interview people who'd been involved in authoritarian channeling cults, and most of them had left because they just got tired of the, you know, of the power issues. They just felt that it blocked their own, you know, their own personal growth, or they just had some blow up with the leader and decided they'd had enough and they moved on. You know, the thing is that people, the press always makes a big deal about religious cults of this sort, but the New Age movement itself doesn't lend itself to that, precisely because it's so individualistic. It's hard to make a case I think other religions do a better job of, you know, asserting control over people.
Absolutely. I mean, there's another point you make too that you know, I had never thought about either, or one of the people you interviewed made, was, oh, but look, it's so commercial. They're charging for this, and they're selling this, and da 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 da. And then one person's like, hey, look, the market is actually it's just a more workable system than the other ways that other religions use to extract money and you know, create economic hierarchies and forms of power. It's actually just more. It's just more available, and I never really thought about it that way, because you know, there's a strange thing that happens on people who are critical of religion, and I say this including myself to some degree, where it's this two-faced thing where on the one hand you want to bring the phenomena down, say, oh, these guys are just lying, or they're manipulating people or whatever, and yet because it's religion, there's this idea that they should still be better or different than everyone else. It's like, what are those New Age guys doing, like making money off these DVDs and saying they have some kind of, you know, tap in on these cosmic forces? And you're like, yeah, but they're just doing what everybody else does.
The Catholic Church sells tickets to heaven.
And it seemed to me like there was a way in which they accepted that aspect of it.
Yeah, well, there's no question that, you know, that the dependent, vulnerable personalities could be drawn into relationships in the New Age movement or any other religious movement in unhealthy ways and destructive ways. But again, I just didn't, and I had my, you know, I had my notebook open. I mean, I was ready to document that sort of thing if I saw it, and I just didn't see very much of it, precisely because it was so fluid. I mean, if you just didn't like what you heard, you just walked to the next workshop, you know. Now, that leads to the accusation that it's a kind of religious shopping, or that it's sort of capitalism meets spirituality, or Walmart spirituality. I mean, there are all these terms that get used. And frankly, again, there's some truth to that. I think that the level of commitment is fairly low, and that limits how far the group can go with certain kinds of projects. And so I think those are legitimate critiques of the movement, but what I didn't like was the people who just would write these snarky things about the content of the religious vision of a New Age teacher of one sort or another, and yet they would never submit, you know, one of the major religions to the same kind of analysis. It was sort of like the major world religions are considered kind of off limits for that kind of literalist interpretation, whereas people felt free to just make fun of, you know, out of context statements from various New Age practitioners of New Age spirituality. Now, some of whom say silly things. I mean, but it seemed like there was a double standard, and so I was trying not to fall into that when I wrote the book. I have to say that the field work was fun and interesting. The writing was really hard because of constantly trying to, you know, be fair-minded, but as the saying goes, you know, not so open-minded that my brains fell out. I mean, you know, where, you know, to really sharply define some of these issues and then let the reader decide whether it was a good thing or a bad thing.
Well it's really true. Go ahead,
Masha.
I just wanted to say, I think it's so funny, and I wish someone would, like, take a passage that Ramsa channeled and put it next to something the Pope said, you know? Because you can, if you scrutinize it in terms of that, like a true anthropologist, and look at it, like, in relationship to everything else and put it in context, I mean, literally, when you put these things side by side, you can not only see the relationship, but you can see the similarity between them. So, I mean, I think that's an important thing to say.
Well, that's right. And when you have an established institution that encompasses and embraces millions of people, it has a kind of automatic authority. It's just not subject to the same kind of critical questions that you would ask of a group of 20 people sitting in a room talking about some spirit they channeled.
Mm.
But of course, that religion, Christianity, started with a small cult of people, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
But it now is, it's a worldwide church. You can say this for any major world religion, and so somehow becomes immune to that kind of analysis. So I felt that what I was doing was just following within the anthropological tradition, but I wanted to bring some wit to it. I wanted to be engaging and interesting and fun, but not making fun of people. I mean, this is the sort of subtle point you have to make. I really liked the people I worked with. I didn't really want to say hurtful things unless I felt that they were really engaged in something that was disreputable.
Well, one of the things about the book is also it's so readable and well written and just engaging. It's not larded over with anthropological theoretical debates and sort of this sort of alienating academic language. But in a way, that makes you even more exposed to the criticisms from within your field. It's like, look. Yeah, great. Michael went out and hung around a bunch of bubblehead, mystics, and then he wrote this book and quotes them a lot. And like, where's the rigor, man? And I'm kind of curious, like, how, especially at that time, things that I think have changed a little bit, but especially at that time inside kind of anthropology, wasn't this still sort of not risky work, but at least like kind of a little bit exposed?
Well, there were interesting moments along those lines. So for some reason, working with the New Age is just it's like the third rail of anthropology and maybe sociology too, not religious studies. So when I worked with the Awaruna, people never said we talked about it. I hang out with other Amazonians, but when people found out that I was working with New Agers, one of my closest friends said, "You don't believe this stuff, do you?" I mean. It was just sort of assumed that if I was involved in it, I must have become a convert or something, which nobody ever said to me, "You're not becoming a Awaruna, are you? I mean, are you becoming a shaman?" So I actually think that religious studies scholars, the reception of the book was much better in religious studies because there's a tradition of that kind of approach to exotic religious practices, whereas in anthropology, and part of the reason is that the New Age is so threatening. There's the cultural appropriation thing that as anthropologists, are upset because New Agers do and have borrowed, elements of spirituality, especially from Native Americans, in ways that are deeply troubling to many anthropologists. And I mentioned before I shared my concern about that. But the other thing is that a lot of it almost seems too much like anthropology, so it's even more threatening precisely because in some ways New Age people often quote works from anthropology that they feel, support their understanding or their vision, and I think that's deeply threatening to certain anthropologists.
Well, it's also threatening because it's like it's them. Like anthropologists traditionally look at savages or non-white people, but these are like Americans that are, white Americans doing this in America. They're not like, the savages in the bush that we can look at in a kind of powerful position. It's like
right. Peer
anthropology.
Yeah, well, I think that makes people feel freer to be critical. But the book did get hammered by some reviewers who said I wasn't critical enough. I mean, okay, yeah, it's a nice book, it's fun to read, but, where's the beef? Why isn't Brown hammering these people for their moral relativism, the silliness of their views? And, my view is that it wasn't my job to trash a community any more than I would expect any anthropologist to. I mean, I had to make a choice early in the work, which is, ethnography takes so long and takes so much out of you. Do you really want to spend, X number of years working with people you can't stand and then writing? I mean, I just worried that it would contaminate, contaminate me with kind of pessimism. And so early on in the project, I got far enough into it. I said, okay, here's a choice. I got to make a choice now. Am I going to go with this or I'm just going to drop it? And after I got, I did a few months of work, interviewed a bunch of people, and I said, I can do this. I mean, I see enough positive here. I see enough that's uplifting and, in any event, not destructive, that I feel I can go forward and be reasonably fair-minded about it. If I'd really felt that they were engaged in some, quasi-criminal activity, I would have stopped. I just would have terminated. And I have terminated other projects for similar reasons.
Well, Michael, we're winding down here, and I just for the last couple of minutes, first I wanted to let people know that if they go online to the Williams website and do a search on your name, they can come up with a number of your articles as well. But what are you doing now? Are you about to embark on some other ethnology, or what's your project on the horizon?
Well, the most recent project that I completed actually was on cultural appropriation, so I kind of went from the New Age book saying I'm not going to think about appropriation to then writing a book about appropriation. Not so much involving the New Age, but about biopiracy and the appropriation of elements of indigenous cultures and what we can do about that. So it was a much more morally focused book or ethically focused book than the New Age book. But right now I'm thinking of a really wild project, kind of underdeveloped, but I'm fascinated by groups who are engaged in ultra long-term thinking. I mean, we live in an ultra short-term culture these days, and you know, businesses used to work on 3 to 5 year plans, and now they go from, you know, quarter to quarter, and the news cycle gets faster and faster, and people only care about what's happening next week. And I'm identifying organizations that are involved in work, very concrete work, that is supposed to produce a specific result, but the time span that it's going to be required is probably beyond the lifespan of an individual life, or certainly of a working life. And I'm just curious about what it takes. How do people find rewards and satisfactions when it's very likely that they will actually never see the full fruit of what they're engaged in? So I'm just right now in the process of identifying organizations that kind of meet that standard. The one that interests me a lot, and which I have tremendous respect for, is the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, which was created by Wes Jackson, very well-known person who's often identified with Wendell Berry. They're close friends. And Jackson, who's an agronomist, decided that the human race made a terrible mistake when we domesticated annual grains rather than perennial grain crops and pulses or beans and legumes. And so for the last 30 years, the Land Institute has been involved in domesticating perennial wheat and a perennial legume and perennializing sunflower and sorghum, I believe. The idea of trying to mimic ecologically the structure of the indigenous prairie. And the idea is that they'll have a new form of agriculture that doesn't require inputs, that conserves the topsoil, because the U.S. still has some of the best topsoil in the world, and we're losing it at a terrifying rate. And they're about 30 years into the project, and they probably have another 20, 30 years to go. And the audacity of it.
It's the audacity. That's a really great. Well, good luck on that project. We gotta go now. And thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Great to talk to both of you.
Thanks.
From me and Maja, keep your minds open.